OMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, Apple Music, Blinkbox, Beastie Boys and Dave Grohl's Gammy Leg. I'm CMU editor Andy Malt, and with me is CMU business editor Chris Cook. And Chris, what have you been up to since last week's podcast?
So much since last week's podcast.
Because obviously I haven't seen you since then.
Obviously I listened to the CMU podcast, which sounds a bit egotistical, I know. But
I listened to it twice.
I listened to it twice. But the first time it was quality control, because it was the first of the podcasts since we've returned after our short 2-year break. So the first time I was listening just to check that it was still, you know, acceptable to publish. And then the second time I listened to it to enjoy it as a listener. But yes, so that's the main thing I've done this week, is listen to our own podcast.
We went to the Houses of Parliament.
We did go to the House of Commons for the music industry's annual parliamentary bash, which is where you get all the music industry people over here and all the MPs over here, and everyone's meant to be schmoozing and networking, but it seemed to be that the MPs were doing their thing over here and the music people were doing their thing over here. I'm sure Brian May was working the room, though.
Yes.
I bet Brian May got chatting to the political types as well as all just the music people in the room too. So, yes, so in addition to listening to myself, I went to the Houses of Parliament and listened to some other people too. So it's not been an entirely egotistical week.
No. It's been an interesting week, though. I wouldn't say there's been a huge amount of news this week, but there has been one big story dominating everything, and that is Apple Music still.
It is. It's been a big running story this week. As we record this podcast, it's getting to the point now where it's getting a little bit tedious, this story. But I'm confident that by the time you listen to this podcast, we'll have got over the tedium bit and everyone will be excited about this story again. So we're going to inject a bit of excitement in the story that does feel like now that it's running and running and running and running. So yes. We talked about Apple Music a lot last week.
We did. We talked about the
service.
The launch, the service, what the service is doing.
Andy dissed it greatly.
Yeah, that happened.
So last week was all about Andy Malt's problems with the all-new Apple Music, with iTunes and the Beats Radio and the streaming service and Kinect and all of those other things. This week, the story has not been about the service because the service ain't gone live yet. So beyond what was unveiled earlier this month, we don't really know much more about what the service is going to look like, because until the 30th of June, we don't have it. This week, it's all been about the deals behind the scenes and the contract between Apple and the labels.
Yes, well, specifically the indie labels, because as with pretty much every streaming service, it was announced with deals with the major labels all in place,
because just about
with the, you know,
they're signed with
possibly hours to spare. But because those are the companies that own most of the recordings in the world, particularly Universal, and want to launch a music service, you have to have their music. Now, really, I mean, the indie labels own a lot of music too, but they tend to come after the fact, and their deals are not signed yet, or for the most part not signed.
When it comes to Anglo-American repertoire, obviously once you get into the Asian markets, the majors are not so dominant, but in terms of Anglo-American repertoire, which is what most services in the US and Western Europe launch with, you're right. I mean, the majors control somewhere between 75 and 80%. So by having a Universal deal, your Sony deal and your Warner deal, you do have about 80%. It leaves about 20% for the indies. And usually when you have a new streaming service, the way those streaming services access that, the independent repertoire, there are a number of distributors who, between them, represent many, 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 many labels and also all those self-releasing artists, the people who put out their own content. So you do deals with people like Believe and with Ingrooves and with The Orchard, and there are a bunch of others too. But then about half of the indie market you get through doing a deal with an organisation called Merlin. So Merlin isn't a distributor. It's a body that exists simply to negotiate the deal. So all of the independents who want to pump their content direct into a streaming service recognise that if they do a deal as one, so rather than the 20,000 labels Merlin speaks for each doing their own deals, if they all do a deal as one, then they can get a better deal, because between them they control what, 10-12% of certainly the Anglo-American repertoire. So although they're not as big as Sony or Universal, they can get some good terms. So normally when streaming services are going live and it's all about the indie labels doing their deals, normally second after the majors, all eyes are on Merlin. But this time, no. Because iTunes predates Merlin. When iTunes originally did its deals with the labels over 10 years ago, and the same thing happened then. They did the deals with the majors and then they sort of forgot about the indies. There was no Merlin. And every time Apple has enhanced its digital service, so when they added Match and when they added, what else did they do? iTunes Radio in the US, Ping, of course.
Of course. Don't forget Ping.
Every time they added something, they've simply revised the existing contract. So unusually, Merlin is not involved in this. So each of the indies has been sent a contract. We know what that contract looks like because Digital Music News, again, have leaked it.
Digital Music News has sort of become the go-to
central
place for leaks
if
of
you
contracts.
Like long, tedious contracts, then go and download them from Digital Music News. And so all the indies are doing it separately, and at least some of them, we know for a fact Beggars Group, because they have gone public. Most other people are speaking through their trade bodies, so AIM here in the UK and A2IM, if that's how they say it, I assume they do, over in America, have issued statements on behalf of their members. But Andy Maltz, tell us, what is it that the indies have a problem with in this contract? Because there's some specific points, and one in particular, that most labels are honing in on.
Yeah, the specific point that everyone's really kind of taking issue with is the fact that there's going to be a three-month free trial on this new service to try to get people in. There's not, as we discussed last week, there isn't a freemium level to it generally, or there won't be as time goes on. But when it initially launches, the first 3 months will be free. And Apple, in its contract, says it doesn't want to pay royalties on that free trial period.
At all to anybody?
At all to anybody. Nothing. And that, for a variety of reasons, is a problem for the indie labels. A big problem is Spotify. Spotify has become a big revenue stream for a lot of labels. For a lot of indie labels, it's the biggest revenue stream now. And the concern is that if you make this, you know, three month free trial look good and attractive, you'll pull people away from Spotify, and suddenly you've got no money.
And also,
anywhere.
There's the download element as well. I mean, one of the rumours was, and it would make sense that they would do this, Apple are so now set on making Apple Music work that one of the things they will probably do is that when you go into the download store and you go to download an album, as you're clicking the button to buy, it will probably say, well, have you thought that rather than downloading this album, why don't you sign up to Apple Music for £10, $10 a month, access this album and all the other albums? And if Apple are overtly taking people away from downloads, I mean, you mentioned that for a lot of indies, Spotify is the biggest revenue stream. If that's not the case, then almost certainly the iTunes download store is.
Yes.
So the fear is for these 3 months of freebies for everybody, including Apple, what if we lose some Spotify revenue over here, some download revenue over here? And for indie labels on tight cash flow, tight profit margins, if they've got some big releases coming out over the summer and they would expect, you know, a surge of listening on the streaming platforms and a surge of downloads through iTunes around the release, they might not get any money. And that could have a big hit on sort of the cash flow and the finances of smaller independent labels.
Yeah, majors are more likely to be able to take that hit for 3 months, whereas indies often are living kind of release to release. And certainly on that, yeah, as you say, that initial burst of interest in a new release. And if you're not earning any money off that initial burst of interest, you might not really get anything at all. And it might, you know, be the difference between being able to release your next album or not.
And it's just, obviously, when Beggars put out their statement about this, so I say the trade bodies have all issued statements, but Beggars also put out a statement. It was basically what they had sent out by email to their artists and the managers of their artists, but they then posted it on their website, knowing that Digital Music News would leak it anyway. One of the things they said is, you know, it is always a concern for us as an independent label of, you know, are we getting as good a deal as the majors, or are the majors, you know, using their market dominance to get some extras that we, the independent labels, won't see? And indeed, that's why normally the indies license services like this through Merlin, the argument being that by collectively doing it as one, you can get more of those little perks that the majors get. That said, everyone we've spoken to is saying the majors aren't getting royalties during the free trial period either. This isn't something that they're specifically forcing the indies to do. It's across the board. And we do know that this was one of the sticking points for the majors when they were doing their deals, which, as we said, were still being negotiated right the way up to the unveiling of Apple Music earlier this month. But one of Apple's arguments, and this argument has been explicitly made by one of the guys at Apple that has been negotiating the licensing deals, is long term, we are proposing to pay a slightly higher royalty than most of our competitors, by which they probably mean Spotify. Okay, and so the talk has been that whereas we know, and these are figures are always approximate, but that Spotify is paying over around about 70% of its revenues over to the music industry, that Apple will ultimately, once they've paid both the labels and the publishers, be paying over about 73% of their revenue. They seem to be slightly less in US, which might be to do with the compulsory licensing on the publishing side. But Apple are saying, overall, we're going to pay you slightly more. So help us now with this massive 3-month free trial. We're all having to take a hit, but long term, we will pay you more. And I suppose for the majors, that may well be what convinced them. Because as you say, the majors can afford to take a little hit now if there's a promise of more money down the line. Whereas the indies might say, well, that's okay. Even if we think that's a fair deal, even if we recognise... I mean, obviously, there's also the issue that we all know Apple have so much bloody money.
Yes, so, I think that's another thing that's annoying people. You know, the wealthiest company in the world is going, well, we can't possibly afford to pay you.
But even beyond the emotional anger of that, there's an element of saying, even if we buy the, okay, your proposal, you know, free trial, 3 months now, but a little bit more money down the line. Even if we buy that and say, all right, then that's a fair deal, for smaller independents, maybe not something the size of the Beggars Group, but for smaller independents, there's the pragmatic, but we just can't afford it. We can't afford to take that hit over summer 2015 on the promise of something in 2016, because whereas the majors can ride it out and they'll make the money down the line, we need the money now. So it will be interesting to see what happens. My gut instinct is, I mean, certainly people we speak to who have an insight on Apple are not expecting Apple to budge on this.
Apple don't tend to budge on things.
And I mean, the independent sector have fought battles with iTunes before, back in the early days. I mean, Alison Wenham, who runs the Association of Independent Music, if you ever meet her, get her to tell you the story about how when she picketed the original launch of iTunes in the UK and the angry phone call she got from Steve Jobs the next day. And Alison, in true style, was very sort of like, well, Steve, if you won't sign up the indies, we're going to come and ruin your event. So you know, they have done this before. Having said that, since those, you know, initial fallouts in the early days, the indies now have a great relationship with iTunes, and yeah, iTunes is an incredibly good service for them, and the indies have embraced iTunes, so they do generally have a good relationship with Apple. But you don't sense that that good relationship is going to extend to the biggest tech company in the world saying, all right then, have some royalties for this free trial period. So it will be interesting to say, will the indies boycott it? Will the indies say, right, that's it, we just won't sign up for the streaming service, certainly not for the 3 months, so that when Apple Music launches next month, it will do so without all or at least some significant indie label releases. So it remains to be seen whether or not that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see. Obviously, we had a similar standoff about this time last year with YouTube, and this hasn't been, although it's been a quite angry debate, it's not been as angry as that. And certainly in terms of kind of ATIM and AIM's statements on this, their statements have kind of been, well, we can't support this deal, but you guys do whatever you want. You guys being the labels. Whereas, yeah, this with YouTube, it was just, we're not doing this deal. None of us can do this deal. This is awful. But that was a different situation. Why?
I suppose the big difference is all in, all out. So the allegation with the YouTube deal, so that was the deal for YouTube streaming service MusicKey, that a year on hasn't really launched. No. It's been in beta for a very long time.
After all that fuss.
And there are some people now suspecting that it will never launch, and actually it was just a ruse by Google to keep the labels happy that they were developing some sort of subscription service down the line, so shut up moaning about our free thing over here. But yes, so the issue with the YouTube argument was that what Google seemed to be threatening with YouTube MusicKey was, you either sign up to our new streaming service on our terms, or you lose access to the entire YouTube platform. And what that would really mean is you will no longer have the option to monetize your videos on YouTube. So you'd have to continue taking all those videos down through the Content ID system, but you'd only have the option to block. You wouldn't have the option to monetize. So you are either all in or all out. And obviously that led to Impala, which represents the indie labels at a European level in Brussels, saying that, well, that's anti-competitive, because you're basically using your market dominance over here in the free video space to force people into less good terms on a streaming service over here. despite one artist saying on Twitter that there was an element of All In, All Out about this.
Well, it's Anton Newcombe from Brian Jonestown Massacre claims to have been told that... he initially said that he'd been told if he didn't sign up to the deal, all his music would be taken off iTunes entirely. He later, in kind of conversations with people about it, said that it was not just him, but his distributor Cargo was being threatened with having all their content taken down. Although I've spoken to Cargo and they say that's not the case.
We think he's got the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah.
Certainly the distributors we've spoken to are saying, no, that's not the deal. It's entirely up to you as a label. You know, you can continue to have your content on iTunes download store, you can choose to not put any content in the streaming service, or you could choose to put your catalogue in and keep your new releases out if it's your new releases that you're bothered about. Or perhaps, you know, I mean, let's face it, most labels, especially indie labels, put a huge chunk of their new content on SoundCloud as a promotional thing.
Well, they're putting up full album streams on SoundCloud. Where they're not getting any money from that.
I mean, okay, we know that Merlin has now done a deal with SoundCloud. There will be some monetization down the line, but there ain't been yet. So, you know, plenty of indies are already doing a bit of freemium over here, not making any royalties in order to build a buzz that they hope will then become downloads or possibly premium streams through whatever service. So, you know, some labels are already doing this, so use Apple like that. And put your catalogue in, hold back your releases, except as soon as you put a release up on SoundCloud or wherever, then put it into Apple Music as well. So that is an option.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I suppose that... I mean, I suppose the big issue is the length of time of this free trial, because I think it's fairly standard practice for streaming services not to pay royalties on free trials.
But certainly nearly all of them have a 2-week or a 1-month free trial as part of the deal.
They tend to be shorter free trials, and they're sort of, you know, they're staggered in terms of when your users come in and use those free trials. But this is obviously Apple. It's going to be they're going to do a big promotional push on it. It's going to be a lot of people signing up to it at the same time. And then, you know, Beats got 100,000 people in its first, whatever it was, month, 90 days, something like that. And
one would hope that Apple Music
would
get a lot
Apple
more
Music
than
would get more than that.
Bearing in mind, Beats was just the US and Apple is in, I mean, double the territories that Spotify is in. So I mean, Apple Music will have massive reach from day one.
Yeah, and so I think it's the length of time that potentially a lot of people are going to be listening to a lot of music and it's not going to be paying out at all. That's probably the problem. But as you say, I think ultimately the solution to this is, well, in 3 months' time, this isn't going to be an issue anymore. So hold off for 3 months.
Yeah. So I suppose there is a fear perhaps also of the independents that they say, all right then, yes, okay, there's the flexibility here to stay in the download store, to not be in Apple Music streaming. But we expect there to be a lot of hype around Apple Music. We expect Apple to spend a lot of money on advertising, which will be one of their arguments as to why they shouldn't be paying for the free trial bit, because they're already spending a lot of money to sign people up through ads on a level that no streaming service has ever done before. So there might be the fear that but if we hold out, then actually it's not that we'll still have downloads over here or we'll have Spotify streams over here. It's just that our music won't be seen for 3 months. But who knows? And as you say, it could be one of those big standoffs, lots of people arguing, lots of people rowing, and come October, it will just be irrelevant and everyone will forget about it. But it will be interesting to see come the 1st of July, or 30th of June, technically, when it goes live, just how much indie label content is in there or not.
So sticking with streaming services, but not streaming services launching, Blinkbox went into administration this week.
Streaming services closing.
Yeah. Last Friday, I think the announcement was.
Indeed. So remind us what Blinkbox Music is, was, where it came from, what it was, how it existed.
Well, Blinkbox has a convoluted history. It started as Wii 7. Wii 7 originally was a download service where you downloaded tracks for free, but they had an advert attached to them that I think played the first 5 times you listened to the track, and then you'd have to re-upload it and it would delete the ad. Anyway, that service didn't work.
That was a peculiar little moment in digital music history that you'll probably never hear of ever again, but let's not forget that there was...
Let's remember that there was a point when digital music was that insane. When they realised that wasn't going to work, they turned it into a streaming service, and it operated like that for a while. And then it was bought by Tesco, which Tesco also brought a, video streaming service called Blinkbox at the same time, and then it put Wii7 and the Blinkbox video service and an ebook service, I think, all under the Blinkbox banner. And that was Tesco's big push to kind of have a presence in digital media and digital entertainment.
And it was interesting when Tesco did that for various reasons. A, by the time Tesco bought Wii7, Wii7 originally was basically a Spotify competitor. It put more effort into the personalised radio element.
But yes, it did. It originally had an on-demand streaming service, but then it dropped that and it just went for personalised radio.
And they'd always put more effort into personalised radio than Spotify had. So actually that element of Wii7, I think, was generally better than Spotify, because in the early days, Spotify's personalised radio was rubbish. And then they kept pushing that more and more to the front until eventually they sort of got rid of the on-demand behind the scenes. But their argument for that, I mean, it's cheaper to run a personalised radio service than it is a fully on-demand service for licensing reasons. The licence that you get for personalised radio, you don't have to pay as much. So there was clearly commercial reasons for them to go the personalised radio
route. But they did. They always maintained that it was that was what their audience wanted. They had a younger audience who wanted the personalised radio stream.
Yeah, and they were
weren't really using the on-demand.
They were going for a more mainstream audience than perhaps Spotify. Yeah. That, and we all know that, 80% at least of the population, 30 million tracks is way more than they need and actually way more than they can cope with. And so the argument was, the average man on the street, when they open up a streaming service, they don't want to have to decide which of these 30 million tracks they want to listen to. They want to press a button and have music play. And so that's why Wii7 have put personalised radio to the front. It then made sense for Tesco to buy that, because if ever there was a company for whom the 80% mainstream users was their customer base, it was Tesco. And so it was interesting what they were doing. And then, of course, Tesco launched their own tablet and all the Blinkbox apps.
And it all went through,
were on there.
You got access through that.
And then actually, they never properly did this, but the idea that merging ebooks and video and music, and obviously that's sort of what Amazon are doing, especially in the US under the Amazon Prime brand. But the idea that, the average person probably doesn't want a standalone music service, but will gladly take a standalone music service as part of a video service and an ebook service. Although I'm not quite sure they ever did the gluing together bit as well as they suggested.
No. Well, and then so to continue the potted history of Blinkbox. As I'm sure we all remember, Tesco hit the skids a bit, and
this brings us to last year now, isn't it? When Tesco suddenly went with half a billion missing from their accounts or something.
They were having some financial problems and decided they were going to strip back what they do, and they got rid of all of that. And so they sold Blinkbox in January to an Australian streaming service called Guvera.
Now, we should add the little asterisk there that says they sold the music bit to Guvera, having sold the video on demand bit to TalkTalk, because TalkTalk wanted to launch a video on demand element. And then they just shut down the ebooks, I think. I think they just deleted that.
So no one wanted it.
So now you've brought in Guvera. So who are Guvera?
Well, Guvera, as I say, are an Australian streaming service who have been kind of expanding around the world. I think they have a particular presence in India and Asia, but they're not very big in Europe.
No, not at all. But interestingly, if I remember rightly, they began as ad-funded downloads as well, because they've been around a lot longer than I think most people think. And originally, they were trying to build a download platform that had ad funding. Likewise, that was pretty much out of the window quite early. But I suppose what is interesting about Guvera, quite what their service is seems to vary from country to country. Sometimes it has on-demand, sometimes it's just personalised radio. But they're very into the ad-funded element. And one of Guvera's arguments is everyone's given up on advertising way too soon. Spotify originally said its freemium element was a standalone business. They never sold much advertising. They now talk about freemium as simply being a sales tool to sell premium. Whereas Guvera say, no, there's a load of advertising money to be had. It's just that no one's made an effort to sell it right, to get the right brands in. Guvera, I think, rather than having sort of radio-style ads, they do a lot more branded channels and having parts of the service that have sponsors and things like that. So Guvera are an interesting service. They are growing quite rapidly in mainly Asia and also, obviously, the Australian region. But this seemed to be them, we assumed, entering the UK market.
Yeah.
And I think it was my assumption that eventually they would just basically rebrand Blinkbox as Guvera and then start bringing in their ad-funded platform into this market.
Yeah, but then, I think this has been happening over a couple of months, but over the last week we started to notice, people we knew being made redundant. kind of like one at a time over a few over the course of a couple of weeks.
Although, I mean, I suppose when we first started noticing that clearly there was some downsizing going on. Having said that, given that our assumption was they were going to take Blinkbox and turn it into Guevara, which already existed, that actually that wouldn't necessarily be a surprise.
No, but then Friday last week they announced that they were in administration and the service is being shut down.
So, yes, so the Blinkbox company is still a standalone company, even though Guevara bought it. They have put it into administration. The rumour is that the people who run it attempted a management buyout. That didn't work. The administrators are trying to sell it.
Yes.
Although we were surprised anyone bought it when Tesco was selling it.
Well, it's interesting in the statement from the administrators, who are Smith and Williamson, if you're
interested in buying
it, or just administrators in general, who said in their statement that the company had faced significant financial pressure in recent months since its acquisition, and it was in a highly competitive industry, and despite its active user base. Had continued to struggle financially, and they had tried to achieve a quick sale, but that had failed.
Which I assume was the
management buyout, and so they had to put it into administration.
But it's interesting when a company buys and exists. Given that there are no profit-making streaming services, they're all loss-making businesses. When people buy an existing service, it's like, well, what are they buying? Because usually these days, if you buy a streaming service, all of the licenses the streaming service has with labels and publishers immediately come up for renewal, because licensing deals say if a new owner comes in, you have to renegotiate. So you're not buying the deal. Are you buying the brand? Guevara already has a brand. Are you buying the platform? Guevara already has a platform. Are you buying the ad sales experience? Guevara already has the ad sales experience. So presumably the only thing they really wanted was all of the sign-ups, was the subscribers and the email addresses, some of whom were active users, many, many more of whom had expressed an interest but never really become an active user. So I'm guessing the real thing they're interested in is a database, which I suppose leads to the conspiracy theory. Will they now try and buy that database through the administration without the liabilities of the actual going concern company?
Yes, and if it's a service, well, as you say, it was a service who was fairly surprised that's been bought and sold so many times already anyway. So it's quite possible that the real kind of saleable bit of the company really is its database now, which is something like, I think they have a bit over 1 million active users, but in terms of the email addresses they've got on file, it's I think about 2.4, 2.8 million.
I would say less active users than that. But it's not existing anymore. So they've got no active users as the whole thing winds down. It will be interesting to see if anyone buys it. I would be surprised if anyone would buy it as a going concern. They might buy some of the assets. And it is a shame, because although it was always, it was never quite on level with Spotify, even back in the early days where it was more of a straight Spotify competitor. I think it was one of those services where there was an element of, you're right that for mainstream consumers, the 30 million tracks on demand whenever you want to listen to it isn't the right service for the 80% mainstream consumers. And you sort of felt that Blinkbox were dabbling in that space in an interesting way. Therefore, Tesco Alliance, that was interesting. And you felt there was potentially something there, but perhaps they were a little bit too early to market. Perhaps they never got it quite right. But you sort of sense now that we will never find out whether what we thought were interesting and possibly good elements of Blinkbox, whether or not they will work. Well, chances are now we will never find out.
No, I mean, I think we discussed last week the kind of the need for mid-level services, and Blinkbox is one of those. We're now faced, so the next attempt to build a mid-level mass market service is RDO Select, which you can't get in Europe.
Yet.
Hopefully in the next month, their CEO said this week to Music Week.
So RDO Select launched in the US and elsewhere, I think, about six weeks ago.
Yeah.
So obviously RDO is interesting as a streaming service in that they are a Spotify competitor, except premium is like Spotify, but freemium is like Pandora. So it's personalised radio for free, fully on demand for £10 a month, which is interesting and potentially, I would say, the future. And clearly now they're trying to do something in the middle. So what do you get? It's $4 a month, I think?
Yeah, $3.99, and you get the personalised radio ad free. You also get 25. You can have 25 downloads at any time on your phone. So if you hear a track you like it, you can download it to your phone to listen to later, and you can update your playlist of 25 songs, once a day, And you also get higher quality streaming, which I assume is less of a draw, but, you know, it's a thing to have.
So it's personalised radio without the ads. It's a little bit of on-demand with the 25 tracks that you've decided that you want to be able to listen offline. Of course, as we discussed last week, the problem with all of these mid-market services is, well, what am I getting for $4 that I don't get for free over here on Spotify? And I suppose the two things that they're selling there is, well, A, you get more mobile functionality, because the one thing you don't get on Spotify free is the full mobile experience and offline listening and things like that. So there's a bit of mobile functionality they're selling you for £4 or $4 or whatever, which you're not getting on Spotify free. There's also this element, again, that for a lot of people, 30 million tracks is a turn-off. And perhaps 25 tracks, I mean, I'm not sure 25 is enough, but if it was 100 tracks and there was some help in you putting those 100 tracks together, it recommended 100 tracks that you might want to download, I think there is something there. The question is it worth £4 to the average sort of mainstream consumer? And that's the big unknown. It possibly isn't enough, in addition to what you get from Spotify free, to make people pay.
Yes. So as much as we've discussed the need for mid-market services, no one's really managed to get one going yet.
No.
But it remains to be seen if RDO can succeed where Blinkbox and Bloom FM before them
and
have,
many
have failed.
So fingers crossed that they've managed to crack it.
Yeah.
So that's enough digital music for now, I think. Tell you what, let's focus on the music itself. As we said on last week's podcast, in the new look podcast era of CMU, every week we're going to recap the CMU-approved tracks of the previous 7 days. So every day in the CMU Daily, Andy tips a new track or a new band or a new album or something that's out there that he thinks you should check out. I say Andy does. We do have a few other people who contribute to CMU Approved. Ali sometimes does, Mark sometimes does, and Vigzy, who is best known in CMU land for doing the weekly club tip on a Friday, also occasionally, sometimes, gets to pick something for the main CMU proof too. And he did this week, which
he
is
did.
Why I'm explaining that.
We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. But firstly, the things that Andy tipped. So tell us just very quickly, there ain't much time, but just in a couple of sentences, tell us why you tipped Society earlier this week.
Okay, well, Society, I don't know why did I tip it, because they're good. The end, right, move on. No. So Society first emerged, I think, about 3 years ago as one of those annoying, mysterious musicians. And I don't know if
I've... Sort of like a burial, sort of.
I've discussed this in various places. I'm not sure I've ever discussed it on the podcast, but mysterious musicians are one of my bugbears, because it's just like, it's just someone you've never heard of not telling you their name. It's not mysterious. Anyway, but he emerged from nowhere, and he got into CMU Approved then because he was good.
Not now, because he was mysterious.
No.
Let it be noted.
Let's note that now. But this new track came out this week called We All Have a Price.
No longer mysterious, because we know his name.
And yes, Jamie Girdler, I think his name is. Anyway, this track is the last track to be completed for his debut album. And it's good, like all his other stuff so far. So that's exciting. I think album coming later this year.
Rudy Zygadlo. Is that how we're saying that?
It could be. Rudy Zygadlo is a producer, Scottish producer, who has kind of been knocking around for a while. He's released a couple of albums on Planet Moo. And he's got this new single out, which is self-released, I think, called Scrapbook Sympathies, which is it's kind of him going into. He kind of he has quite a distinct sound, but it kind of wavers through genres. This is him being more pop, and I think it's one of the most satisfying things he's released.
And Miguel.
Miguel needs no introduction, surely. Miguel is a pretty big R&B star in the US. Possibly most famous for once kicking someone in the head while trying to jump between stages at an award ceremony, but he featured on the best track on the last Janelle Monáe album. But he's releasing a new album at the end of this month, his third album, and he's already released 6 tracks from it and the video for one of them this week. And his new stuff is just sounding great. It's really like kind of densely produced, kind of a mix of live and electronic music. It's sort of, I don't know, I don't really want to say it, but there is a bit of a Prince edge to him. He's good. His new stuff's sounding good. I'm looking forward to hearing the whole album.
So go and listen to Prince-infused Miguel new material. Finally, Vigzy's approved. Tell us why Vigzy's approving the new Orb.
Vixie is proving the new Orb album because Vixie likes the new Orb album.
Vixie likes the Orb a lot.
But he said that this is... I mean, the Orb have been going for nearly 30 years now. 28 years, I think it is, if you're counting. I mean, the lineup has changed over the years with the kind of constant of Alex Paterson. And they've got this new album out called, or coming out, called Moonbuilding 2703 AD. It's out on Monday, I believe. And Vixie reckoned that was kind of a return to sort of their early work, their early sound.
So go check that out. Where can you check it out?
You could go to completemusicupdate.com/approved to listen to all of those, what I just mentioned.
And also find out more about why Andy and occasionally Vixie has been approving that music this week.
Okay, so now on to a story that I don't know if we've ever... It's a long-running story, but I don't know if it's long-running enough that it ever got onto the podcast 2 years ago. But it's the Beastie Boys v. Monster Energy Drink, which is an amusing story and a cautionary tale.
It is a cautionary tale. If any of you listening to this podcast happen to work in the world of advertising or marketing or working for brands and using music, this was one of a number. The Beastie Boys had about at least three copyright cases all in court at the same time. So there was a period where the Beastie Boys seemed to be... Well, sometimes there was one, at least one where they were being sued, and there was at least one where they were suing, and I think then there was the other one where they didn't actually sue, but they put pressure on an advertiser.
Yes. Well, they've become very litigious over their music being used when they haven't authorised it. I mean, one of their cases was against a parody. But they're very hot on this because, they never licensed their music to advertising, but specifically in Adam Yauch's will, when after he died, it stipulated that their music, or his music, which, you know, because he owns obviously part of it, should never, ever, ever, ever be used in advertising. And as a result, this is why they've gone so hard on it. And in case, I mean, this is... It's almost sort of like it's an expensive, unfortunate slip-up in this case.
But on the part of Monster. And this one happened, I mean, just after Adam Yauch's death. And indeed, it seemed to be that one of the reasons why they went so hard on this, A, the Beastie Boys, their standpoint is, we never license our music for use in advertising. So therefore, if you use it, then you are, not only are you infringing our copyright, but you are going against our standard wishes. Also, you feel that the surviving Beastie Boys felt that this brand was trying to sort of piggyback on the back of or exploit the death of you know, the very sad premature death of their bandmate. So basically, Monster is an energy drink brand. They did a sporty thing.
It was a snowboarding event.
So they did a snowboarding event, which was just one of those things that brands do. They filmed it. They put together a video, which went up on their YouTube channel. The DJ who was DJing at the after...
So I think it was DJ Zinc.
At the rap party, then sort of mixed some music together for the video. It was predominantly Beastie Boy tracks all being sort of edited together. I think there was four or five in total across the mix. They then put that video up on YouTube. Then very quickly, the Beastie Boys said, hey, hang on a second. You know, we never signed that off. Why are you using our music? Monster... To be fair, took the video down quite quickly.
It was not up there for very long at all.
And then subsequently, through their lawyers, said, okay, you're right. We shouldn't have used your music. We didn't have permission. We screwed up there. But can we license in hindsight? Can we pay you a bit of money for the however many few thousand people saw the video? And the Beastie Boys basically said, no, copyright infringement, we're going to sue you. I think perhaps they did say, all right then, we'll license you with hindsight. We'll have $2 million, please. And at that point, Monster said, we were thinking more a few thousand, possibly low tens of thousands. $2 million seems like a lot of money. So the Beastie Boys went to court. And they won. And you know, the Beastie Boys themselves, the two surviving Beastie Boys, were in court. They gave quite emotional, hardline stances saying, we will never license our... So it's not just a case of us trying to screw more money out of these people, we're basically saying that that you went against our well-known, well-documented wishes, which is that we will never put our music to any brand, and that is why we are pursuing such high damages. It was a jury case. Now, we've had this, the Blurred Lines copyright case, that obviously we haven't talked about on the podcast because we weren't here when it happened, but it was earlier this year. It's one of the peculiarities of American law that quite often copyright cases go before juries, which wouldn't happen over here in the UK. And juries in copyright cases always seem to reward ridiculous damages to copyright owners.
It is
owners.
Often in the high millions. I mean, so, not the high millions, above a million.
So, as happened here. So the Beastie Boys got... It wasn't quite what they were asking for,
the
but
Beastie
it was
Boys
still...
wanted... What did they want? Was it two? 2 million?
I can't remember, but it was... They didn't get quite what they wanted.
They got 1.7 million.
Which is a lot of money. And then Monster appealed.
That
failed late last year. So basically, Monster are going to have to write a check. We'll come to what this week's development was. But before we do why this back in the news this week, let's remind ourselves of the most amusing part of this case, which was during the actual trial where Monster were trying to say, and as I say, the starting point for the drinks brand was, OK, we screwed up. We owe you a bit of money. We just don't think that we owe you 1.7 million. And through that testimony, we discovered what had happened behind the scenes.
Well, they believed that they'd had approval. From
and how did they believe that?
Well, I think it was the agency who created the video rather than Monster themselves, but they'd emailed the video that they created over to DJ Zinc, who had mixed the tracks.
Yes, and they'd put his track to the video footage of all this snowboarding with the Monster logo.
And they'd said... So here's the video, just so you can have a look. And he emailed back, dope!
Which seemingly that was the only word in the email.
And they took that to mean, yes, you have approval to use this music from the Beastie Boys in this video, which turns out is not the case.
So it seems to be that whoever was behind this didn't... Well, they should have been on a CMU copyright course. That was basically the moral of this entire story. If the at this marketing agency and in Monster's marketing department have been on one of our CMU Insights courses, they would know that when you use music in a video, you've got to clear it with all the copyright owners, which means you've got to clear it with the record company over here, who may then have to clear it with the artist. It's quite common, even if a record company controls the music, that as soon as an advertising is involved, brands are involved, they have to go and get clearance from the artist, depending on their contract with the artist. Then you have to clear the publishing over here. And just because YouTube is licensed for user-generated content, so, you know, if we were to, I don't know, if you were to sing a Beastie Boys track here
I'm not going to. I wouldn't risk it.
But and we were to upload it to YouTube, then, you know, the owners of that copyright would then have an option to either monetize the content or to block it, but that we wouldn't get in trouble for doing the upload because we're within the YouTube system. But the minute brands are involved, well, often that's not the case. And so, yes, a lesson here. And it's not just the 1.7 million that they already had to pay, because the Beastie Boys also wanted their legal costs covering.
Yes, so that's the development this week, really, is that the Beastie Boys, after being awarded $1.7 million, came back and said, well, we also feel that our legal fees should be covered. And their legal fees were $2.4 million because they'd gone really hard on this case. And that was up in court this week in front of a judge. And the judge disagreed that they should receive quite so much money, but did agree that they should receive some. So has awarded $668,000,
which is still a lot of money for a case of this kind. And you know, Monster having already been a bit shocked that they had to pay $1.7 million, the idea there'll be another $2.4 million in legal costs. And the judge's words were quite interesting. The judge basically said, OK, you are due some legal costs. I'm going to give you significantly more than you would usually get, but you ain't getting anywhere near $2.4 million because you, the Beastie Boys, we understand that this clearly you were deeply offended by the way your music had been used, and that's why you basically threw all this money at the legal costs. But that was your decision. You chose to go. And he talked about the Cadillac route, didn't he? You went the Cadillac route rather than the Honda Civic route. You chose to have the most expensive lawyers to just throw money at it, and so you have to take some of that. And he was basically saying, once you add the damages and what I am awarding you together, you've still made a nice bit of money there. So another, what was it? What was the figure?
668,000.
So do the maths there, in excess of 2.3 million. Mm. all because Monster Energy Drink thought that the word dope from a DJ cleared the copyright. So a little lesson there to the brands of this world, if you're planning on using music, come on one of my training courses. What about politicians who want to use music?
I was going to say, in terms of people being deeply offended, Neil Young was deeply offended, I think quite rightly so, this week. As you may have seen in the news, quite hilariously, Donald Trump is standing for the president. Well, he wants to become the president of America. He's not as close to actually standing.
Yeah, he's standing for the Republican candidacy.
He's standing to be put up the opportunity to become the candidate for president of the United States of America against, you know, such luminaries as Jeb Bush. So much choice. Anyway, so that was this week that he came out and said that. And before he made his announcement, Donald Trump played Rockin' in the Free World by Neil Young, which who could have guessed Neil Young wasn't very happy about?
He wasn't very happy with a Republican candidate using it, let alone Donald Trump.
It was a double double hit there.
Using it. And so, yeah, Neil Young very quickly put out a statement saying, you know, I did not give permission for that and I'm offended by that, etc.
Yeah, the statement came from his management company and the language used was quite strong and said, look, this was not authorised for use. Now, the problem here is not like the Beastie Boys case. The problem here is that Donald Trump did no wrong. I mean, other than, you know, being impolite and not asking first, which you think, you know, I mean, these cases come up fairly regularly.
I mean, it always happens here in the UK. I mean, obviously, every autumn you have the party conference season and you have the party conferences and nobody really cares about the Labour conference. Nobody really cares about the Liberal conference. It's always the Tory conference and they'll pick a track and there'll always be the artist then coming on saying, oh, my God, I can't believe the Tories use my track as some minister was walking on stage. But, of course, the issue is, in the room at the time, generally speaking, public performance of music, whether it's a recording of a music or a live performance, is done through the collective licensing system. And generally speaking, when things go through the collective licensing system, there's no veto. So providing the building where Donald Trump was doing his presentation had their BMI license and their ASCAP license on the song side. Actually, in America, you don't even need a license on the recording side. Copyright law waives that. So providing you have those licenses, which we all assume that they did, then there ain't nothing any artist can do about it.
So when Neil Young said it was unauthorised, in fact, it was authorised. So the problem is
not authorised by him.
It's not authorised by him. It was just annoying for him. And Neil Young also came out and he stated who his preferred candidate was also.
Yes, and of course restated that as a Canadian, he doesn't really have any interest in that. But I suppose what is interesting, and this has come up before in the US, is at an event like that, you don't need to have the permission of the artist or the copyright owner or anybody. You do it under a blanket license from the societies. If, however, you then use it in a video on YouTube, at that point, you do need permission. And the rights owner can block it through the Content ID system. So had Donald Trump then sort of used it in a video that went up on YouTube, suddenly you do then get into the copyright realms. Although I think this is warning. He ain't going to do that because it's quite clear that any use of Neil Young's music is just going to spin into a Neil Young ranting about Donald Trump.
Well, Neil Young, as we know, who just released a concept album based on a group of companies he doesn't like. He's a man who seems quite angry about a lot of things.
But this does happen quite a lot. And obviously, as we run into the presidential election over in America, and there seem to be loads of people standing for the Republican candidacy.
I might do it.
And generally, it's the right-leaning candidates that annoy artists.
Yeah.
You know, the artistic community generally leaning more to the left. So it may well be that this is the first of many angry artists seeing their music used by politicians that they don't enjoy. So that's something to look forward
to. Don Henley you've got to watch out for. He's the one who always goes very, very legal.
So let's keep an eye on that.
Yeah. So we're running out of time here, but we've just run through the things we haven't had time to talk about. I said earlier that there's not been a lot of news.
Yeah, then
this
you wrote
week,
this
and
list.
And now this is a really long list I'm about to read
long
out.
List.
But, well, let's start quickly. Let's go through very quickly. We didn't talk about the UK music tourism generating £3.1 billion in the UK last year.
So we mentioned we were at the House of Commons earlier this week.
This is why.
This was one, you know, at this event, they launched this report saying that music tourism generated that figure, £3.1 billion. Music tourism has a very specific definition, which might not be what you think tourism means, but it is proof that, you know, festivals and big music events, they persuade people to come in from abroad and crucially to travel around the country and often take business into parts of the country, particularly with festivals, that wouldn't have a big influx of tourists normally. So all power to the festivals and live music.
The Queen's birthday honours list.
Yes, some people got it. Van Morrison was the main one on the industry side.
Universal Music's Max Hole.
Yes, and of course Keith Harris from PPL and Music Tank and Artist Management Fame were amongst the music people getting some letters from the Queen.
Warner Music COO Rob Wiesenthal leaving the music industry entirely.
To go and work in the Uber of helicopters or something, one person described it as. I don't know.
Blade,
what he's
it's
doing.
Called, isn't it? Yes.
After a long career in the entertainment industry, previously at Sony.
Talking of Sony, former Sony Music UK boss Nick Gatfield is back after quite a while away with a new company.
Yes, so he made a very sort of speedy exit from Sony Music UK. And he's back with a startup, similar to a couple of other startups that have been launched by X, sort of record company execs or live music execs, basically investing in both music startups but also artist businesses. So that sounds interesting. Don't really know what it means. Don't know where he's getting his money from, but certainly one to look out for.
Conservative MP Jesse Norman being named the new chair of the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, which is interesting. He was a late addition to the ballot.
Well, there you go. And I mean, he has decent credentials, despite being an MP.
Despite being an MP and a Conservative MP, he's...
he plays the trumpet?
He apparently taught himself to read music and play the trumpet in his 40s.
Well, there you go. Interesting thing. Very involved in the Roundhouse.
Yes, his father is a philanthropist and set up the Roundhouse in its current form in 1996.
And all of the educational side of that.
Jesse Norman is a trustee of that. He's also a director of the Hay Festival.
So, somebody with music credentials leading a select committee in Parliament on culture, etc. Peeress Stim and Gamer have a joint venture to try and simplify multi-territory licensing. Tell you what, let's just tell you that got the go-ahead from the European Commission.
Because they're trying to simplify it, but it's very complicated to explain. So let's just move on to Catherine Joseph, won the Scottish Album of the Year Award Wednesday.
Well done.
She gets £20,000
and
a quilt.
Oh, quilt. Quilt.
Yeah. Cassette Store Day is coming back in October for its third attempt to convince the world that cassettes are coming back.
Which gets more entertaining the more they do it.
Yes, I like that day very much. Plan B in Brixton, the nightclub, not the rapper, closed down this week.
But it's this only, is not more Archie style doom and gloom like last week's story.
Only because it has been bought by the Columbo Group, who operate various venues, including XOYO and the Queen's Head in Islington.
And I like what they do with venues.
They're going to refit Plan B and relaunch it later this year.
Nick Grimshaw and Rita Ora have been added to the X Factor judging panel. Yeah, nothing to add.
Nope. Scroobius, Pip, Kynas and the Sierra Leone All-Stars are amongst artists who are contributing to a British Red Cross album that's themed around the stories of refugees, which is a very interesting project I'm looking forward to hearing.
Yeah, lots to say about that.
So each artist will work with a different refugee to get their story and then turn it into a song.
No more time to talk about that now, but do check that out and we'll let you know once, because that's them announcing they're doing it. So,
yes.
So we'll let you know once there's actually some output to listen to. Take That got the keys to the O2.
Which, you know, coveted keys to the O2.
So I suppose if they ever get, if any member of Take That has a little bit of a run-in with their partner, which has happened with at least one of them in the past, they can always go and kip in the O2.
Yes. So, it was for playing more concerts there than anyone else, thanks to Michael Jackson dying.
Yes, because of course they've now done more.
Because they're a way off what Michael Jackson would have done.
Exactly. So they've played more than Prince, who of course opened the O2 as a music venue by doing 21 dates. Take That and now have done 22 dates, providing you include their Brit appearances in that.
Yeah, which is
they've played the Brit Awards.
You do.
But as you say, had Jackson done his 50-night residency, then there would have been no way near getting the keys to the O2.
And finally on this list.
You're asking me to tell you what's finally on this list.
Yeah.
I'm going to read it. Jess Glynn cancels shows to undergo vocal cord surgery. That's not really an and finally on this list, is
it?
I didn't mean
and finally this is funny. I mean and finally on this list.
Oh.
Before I move on, this segue has just collapsed.
Take That with the Keys would have been the best funny one to end.
I know,
on.
But we had a link here because we've got a sickly artist.
Oh, I see. The link is Jess Glynn, ill artist. Let's talk about more ill artists.
Yeah, everyone pretend that went really smoothly.
Okay, leading us in to the final story on this edition of CMU Podcast. We used to have a whole section
in
CMU.
We're so professional.
We used to have a section in CMU Daily in the olden days called In the Pop Hospital.
Yeah.
Which we got rid of because it seemed a bit odd to have an entire section dedicated to ill pop stars. But had we still had that section this week, it would have been the busiest section.
It would have been very busy.
So other than Jess Glynn cancelling shows to undergo vocal cord surgery, what else has been happening in terms of injured pop stars?
Well, let's start with Michael Clifford from 5 Seconds of Summer. He set fire to his head.
He did, and the photos that were doing the rounds did look quite serious. So there's part of me not wanting to make too much light of this, although the official line is that actually he wasn't that badly hurt.
Yes, he came back the next night. They were playing, I think, 3 shows at Wembley Arena, and he came back and played the next night, although they had replaced the fire-emitting pyros with glitter guns.
It was the onstage pyros that clearly...
Yeah, he got a bit too close to one of them and it set fire to his head.
Which, of course, happened. We mentioned Michael Jackson there. Happened to poor old Michael Jackson way back in the day when he was shooting a Pepsi commercial. Very famous, obviously. The footage is still out there on YouTube. A pyro went off. It burnt his scalp. And actually, you know, with hindsight, once we saw the sort of the fallout that came out after his death, we know that he had all of those issues with painkillers and various prescription drug addictions, and often he traced that back to the pain that he suffered post that event.
So there you go, don't do brand partnerships.
That's so no brand partnerships, there. No but pyros, anyway, but so fingers crossed, as far as we're aware, the guy from, I can never remember the name of this band.
5 Seconds of Summer.
6 Seconds of Autumn. despite it looking quite bad in the photos, he's fine, he was back on stage, so it's fine for us to talk about this in our and finally slot.
Yes, and anyway, so he came back on the next night, which is, you know, admirable. But
because they cut short the encore, didn't they?
They did cut short the encore, but they came back and did a full show the next night. But Dave Grohl came back on straight away, almost, when he fell off the stage and broke his leg last Friday.
So, yeah, so initially, Andy Malt, you'll have noted, was saying, ha-ha, Mr. 5 Seconds of Spring, this is how you are a rock star. You fall off the stage, you break your leg, you get back up on stage and say, hey, guys, I think I've broken my leg. You go and get it bandaged, and then you come back on stage and you finish your show in its entirety. Take that, Mr. Young 5 Seconds of Winter. But
now, I think that
with hindsight,
yes. Well, I think...
not as impressive.
I think what happened here is that your head being set on fire is probably a bit more traumatic, and you probably don't get the same adrenaline and shock that you do when you fall off the stage and break your leg. Because Dave Grohl, he wrote a blog post on the Foo Fighters website after this happened, saying that it's the second song of the show in Gothenburg, 52,000 people watching them, which that's embarrassing. But he got back on stage and said, "I think I've broken my leg. Don't worry, I'm going to go and get it sorted out, and I'll come back and we'll finish the show," which, you know, admirable. And he went back, and apparently he got backstage, and they said, "Right, well, you need this to be put in a cast. It's a 20-minute ride to the hospital, and then you'll be in the hospital getting the cast put on. And then, you've got to come back." And he said, "Right, well, that's not going to work. I have to finish this show. They're going to have to bring the materials to put a cast on here. Mr. Paramedic, would you come on stage with me and hold my leg together while I carry on playing?" Which is what he did. I think he played 2 or 3 songs with someone holding onto his leg so it didn't
drop off.
Yeah, he'd broken his leg and dislocated his ankle.
So and all very admirable.
And then, so this happened and everyone kind of went, "Wow, that's amazing, Dave Grohl.
After
you're so
the
great.
Show, some at least one person with common sense arrived on the scene.
Well, he went to the hospital then, and I think the adrenaline and the shock wore off, and they looked at his leg and went, "Yeah, that needs surgery." And so now he has various pins and screws holding his leg together rather than just a man in a yellow jacket.
So despite returning to stage on the night, subsequently, all subsequent European shows that are in the schedule for at least the next month are off.
Yes, and that's bad news for Well, a lot of people, because they had shows at Wembley Stadium and they were due to headline Glastonbury.
And the posters are still all over the tube. I feel like somebody should go around with, I don't know, a plaster and say, you know, due to leg issues, these shows are not happening. But yes, of course, what it meant was no Foo Fighters for Friday night at Glastonbury.
Which means, yeah, very well, and Glastonbury is imminent. So that's a bit of a problem for Glastonbury. So what did they do? There was much speculation in the few hours between it being announced that they weren't going to play and the new headliner being announced.
And so what they did was they took the lineup that they have, they tip-exed Foo Fighters off the top, they then shoved everybody up a line, and now they're trying to find someone to go down the bottom. So basically, Florence and the Machine, who were going to be second on the bill on the Pyramid stage on the Friday night, is now headlining, and they need to do some rejigging down below.
Yeah, which I think is the most obvious thing to have done. It was certainly on the list of ridiculous suggestions you put together. It was number one.
I still think Hanson was the solution. I think they would have flown in and done a fine set.
My favourite was the Foo Fighters tribute act. Yes. I think that would have been my personal preference.
Check them out. The Foo Fighters. The UK's leading Foo Fighters tribute band.
But Florence and the Machine up top, which, you know, obviously just new album out, went to number one. It seems reasonable to put her up there, whether you like her or not.
Someone
did
say it's sort of like phoning up Florence and saying, yeah, you weren't our first choice. But now you can do the headline slot, find another 30 minutes of songs to sing.
Well, everyone, I mean, Taylor Swift was the one most people were saying. Because she's going to be in the country or in the vicinity.
She's got a UK tour that sort of goes over the Glastonbury weekend, but crucially, one of her off days is the Friday. So I think that's why people were saying, Taylor Swift. But, you know, given the fallout when they booked Kanye,
well, I like the idea of just putting Kanye in a second night.
Yes, that would annoy all the rock fans. And it comes to all the point, I mean, on one level, actually, the fallout doesn't seem to have been so high, as certainly not compared to when they announced that Kanye was headlining Saturday, which I suppose is kudos to Florence. Although some people are saying, oh, Florence and the Machine. But as is always the way with Glastonbury, whenever anybody complains about what's happening headline on the Pyramid stage, it's sort of like, you do realise that this is one of many, 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 many stages at this festival. You know, it's entirely possible to have the best Glastonbury in the world and never even stand in front of the Pyramid stage.
Yeah, it's funny. I think the people who complain are quite often people who have either only seen it on TV or have never been.
And probably
aren't
going.
Idiots. And probably aren't going. I mean, there was the guy who started the petition against Kanye headlining.
Yes.
And then the Enemy interviewed him and he said, yeah, I've never been before. I'm going this year. It's like, yeah, it won't matter.
So, you know, kudos to Florence for headlining. Although I think it is worth noting, and this hasn't been so widely reported, that I did have a meeting on Wednesday afternoon with one of the Glastonbury bookers about some other things, Great Escape things. And of course, that had to be rescheduled because he had to fill in the gaps lower down the bill. So he had to go off and phone up agents and book some extra bands in. So I didn't get my meeting. So I think I am the greatest victim of Dave Grohl's broken leg. And
that's definitely
the exclusive conclusion of the story that we've been able to give you here.
You should take a month off to recover, just like Dave Grohl.
Perhaps I will. Perhaps I won't be here on next week's CMU podcast.
Well, tune in next week to find out if Chris is here or not. It's an exciting cliffhanger at the end of this CMU podcast.
That's how you get people tuning in.
In the meantime, go and subscribe anywhere that you might subscribe. Subscribe everywhere that you can subscribe to the CMU podcast. iTunes, Mixcloud, Audio Boom, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spreaker, all of those places. write reviews, ratings. I remembered all of those places. That was very good of me. And join us next week. This is the CMU podcast presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.